Very good. You just have to say you want to be Jewish, and you accept the covenant, and you're in.
Right. Well, there's a little more than that, but you are correct. Nowadays, especially with the chief rabbinate, it's really become more centralized and formalized. So, Susan, if you look in the Rav Lichtenstein book, one of the essays I selected actually is about whether the chief rabbinate is a good development or not. I haven't read it yet, but Rav Lichtenstein deals with that question. So as you can imagine,
that would be very interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So there you go. There's my plug for our Thursday morning class.
I wish I could. I'm sort of overloaded, isn't it?
Oh, all good. I know it's for some people, it's not the most convenient time, but whenever you have free time, you're welcome to join. Okay. So
Rabbi.
Yes, Jay.
This past Sunday, the Federation and I think the Jewish Historical Society had a speaker about the history of anti-Semitism from like ancient times all the way up. I know it was the same time that we had a speaker sponsored by Agudat, but people want to check out to see if it's, I think they recorded it, but it was.
Oh, that would be good. That would be good because it's such a shame they were in conflict.
Yeah, he went to depth about the very how it occurred and throughout history.
Well, that's a shame that they were in conflict, but for those who couldn't make it to Aguda Shalom's event, we have it recorded, so
it was great, it's not public.
Definitely. I'm glad everyone enjoyed
fascinating.
It
absolutely. Let
Alex Patelko know, because I see Marina on here, so yes. So
And yeah, Alex here also. Alex is here.
We all loved the lecture yesterday.
Yes, it was very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
What was recorded? What did I miss? Oh, yeah, yeah.
No, were you at the lecture yesterday? If not, if it was recorded. No.
It was recorded, yes.
Oh, what lecture?
One in the morning?
That's before my time. Mm-hmm.
It was a 10.
She's in a different time zone.
I'm in a different time zone.
Well, anyone who wants to watch it, we didn't make it public on YouTube. It's not searchable because I imagine you put a lot of work into it. So you won't be able to give the same.
No. It's very private.
Yes.
But we do have a private link to it. So if anyone couldn't watch it, email me and I'm happy to send it to you.
Okay. Yeah, and Jake, if you could send out that other link, or or who has it?
I think it was from the Federation.
Check. Okay, I'm sure if one emails the Federation, he'd be happy to share it.
Yeah, it was the Federation of the Historical Society, so I didn't have the link.
Great. Okay, so continuing through our Chuos and Hugo series, I want to just give a little bit of biographical background to Rav Moshe Sternbach. So here's what I'm doing. I played around with the Zoom settings, and I'm now able to share files in the chat. So if you take a moment to look in the chat, you will see, I hope you will see, that there is a PDF over there that says Chuos and Hugos, etc. on it. Can we see that? So if we can download that file, in there is a source sheet that I made a long time ago it doesn't have to be a long time ago, but a few years ago, where I did a mini series where I picked one tshuva from major poskim. So 1 week was Rav Moshe Feinstein, 1 week was Rav Moshe Sternbach, 1 week it was the Sridi Eish. And this was the one I picked when I did Rav Moshe Sternbach. And so that's why it's a complete source sheet. And you can see it says Moshe Kurtz rabbinical student on there instead of assistant rabbi at Aguda Shalom. So this preceded my time here. But the tshuva is still nonetheless very fascinating. And I don't think I've shared it with this group yet. So we will learn it. But what's on that sheet, first of all, since it was made during the summertime when I was a rabbinical student, my friend and I had enough time to actually type up a full translation of the tshuva. So this will be probably the one and only time that you'll have an almost verbatim translation of the source material we're going to be looking at. So take advantage of that while you can. And then also what I want to point out is, I'll share the screen just for now, but once we get to the material, to the source material, I'll turn it off. So this is what the sheet should look like when you open it up. I just wanted to share a little biographical material from Moshe Sternbach. Again, like I said last time, I think Dina said she might be related. I couldn't find a better source than Wikipedia out there when putting this together. I'm not a historian by training, but I think this will give us a basic idea just to appreciate his biographical background. So Moshe Sternbach was born in 1928, and God willing, you know, he should live to a ripe, he's already living to a ripe old age, and he should continue to do so, Mayav Esrim Shana, to 120 years. So he was born in London, in England, which was something I actually never realized. And something that I thought our people in our shul would appreciate is that he learned in his younger years in Torah's Emes, which is a yeshiva in Stamford Hill. So not Stamford, Connecticut, but apparently there is a Stamford Hill in England, which they must have stolen the name from us, right? They definitely didn't have it first. and then he also studied in the Schneider Yeshiva in London. And then in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel, he studied in Brisk, unofficially under Rav Velvel Soloveitchik. Now, who's Rav Velvel Soloveitchik? Anyone know how he's related to the Rav Soloveitchik from YU that we generally think of?
Cousin.
Uncle? Yeah.
Ah, very good. Who said that? Uncle? What?
I did.
I just can't see everyone in one shot. That's Susan. Why. Susan?
Yeah.
Okay, so Susan's correct. Rav Velvel Soloveitchik, known as the Brisker Rav, was the uncle of Rav Yosef Beer Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik from YU. Also, he learned in the Hebron Yeshiva. So what's important right now is in his career, he is known as, he's the Ravad of the Eda HaCharedus in Jerusalem. He's essentially the equivalent, the Jewish legal equivalent of the chief justice of their court. That's very significant because he's living in Israel and he has very significant influence over the Haredi community, which is why last time when we were talking about the topic of vaccination, I said, you know, it would probably be very significant. Again, I don't know why. It might be due to his age. I really don't know his condition, and I want to assume it's because of that. But I haven't seen anything from him about coronavirus. He wrote about measles most recently. So,
Rabbi, I saw a tshuva that he wrote about calling anybody who reports gatherings during this COVID period as a moser.
Oh, really? Where did you spot that?
Yes, I thought that was very. I don't remember because I was curious about him and I looked it up. Oh. But I thought that was a very extreme position.
Oh,
you wrote no. What? Amazing. Dina, I didn't catch that.
So there's a, Dina, what Dina is saying is that there's a halachic category called a moser, which is someone who reports a fellow Jew to the government. So let's say a Jew didn't pay his taxes, and then someone decides to go out of their way and report him to the government. He has a status probably of a moser, or someone reports for any reason, and the government comes after a Jew. And a moser is a very serious category because a moser has a status of a rodev, a pursuer, like someone who pursues someone to kill them. And a moser, therefore, could be punishable by death in the Jewish community. It can even be an extrajudicial killing in order to stop him from harming the Jewish community. So when you call someone a moser, you're basically giving them, you're basically condemning them.
You're giving license to someone else to do something to.
Exactly.
This is a Jewish government. I mean, that's what's interesting. The Moser always was the non-Jewish government, right?
Well, you have to think from the Haredi. Oh, what was that, Zadie?
I said it's a non-Torah government.
Right.
A non-Torah government.
Right. So what my grandfather's pointing out is that Rav Moshe Sternbach is not going to view Israel as a Jewish government. It might be run by people who are technically Jewish, genetically Jewish, or halakhically Jewish, but it's not a Torah government. And this definitely speaks to the Haredi ideology. In the religious Zionist community, people will have questions about, you know, the state of Israel. We have a prayer for it on Shabbos where many people assert that it's the beginning of the redemption of Mashiach. The Haredi community, they would hope it becomes that, but they're definitely not as invested. They definitely don't consider it to be inherently, intrinsically a Jewish government. The land of Israel is Eretz Yisrael, but the state of Israel is not a Jewish state, according to their opinion. So they see it as not only do they see it not see it as a Jewish government, they see it actually as worse than any non-Jewish government because it purports to be a Jewish government, yet it doesn't live up to halacha.
So he considers people who he considers people who report people who don't have vaccines.
What I saw wasn't vaccines; it was gathering. If he reported
gatherings.
Gatherings, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if it was anything else said, but that's what I saw.
So great! I just made a note of that, and if I can track down where that tshuva is, I would love to share that with our group, and maybe that could be our next topic because I'd love to see something contemporary from him addressing what we're in now. But until I have the chance to do that, I have a different tshuva that I want to share tonight, which is, I wouldn't call it a lighthearted tshuva. I mean, has everyone been able to access the document at this point? Anyone having trouble? We're good. You can see it. So this isn't I wouldn't call it a lighthearted tshuva. It's a serious tshuva, but the premise might be a little funny for people who grew up in our culture. So the central question is that you have this father, mother, their son flips out, which is, I'm not going to ask anyone their personal situations here, but flipping out, I don't have the official dictionary definition for it, but essentially it's when you have a more modern, like a modern Orthodox family, they send the kid to yeshiva in Israel for a year or two, and then 2 years becomes 3 years and becomes 4 years, and then he comes back. And YU is not considered religious enough for him. And then he starts questioning his parents' kashrus and if he could stay by them for Shabbos. And I hope this isn't personal experience that we have, but that's a phenomenon called flipping out. It's humorous, but it's also,
it usually happens the other way.
It usually where the parents are firmer and then the kid becomes. It goes both ways. It could really go both ways. I've seen, at least anecdotally, both ways enough times that both are realistic phenomena. But
hey, so my orthodontist kid dropped out of Harvard.
What was that?
My orthodontist kid dropped out of Harvard.
Oh, and went to where instead?
Israel.
To Israel. Okay. So you know, the kids have to have autonomy at some point to make their own decisions, but what gets really interesting is, you know, it's one thing for me to say, okay, look, you have your religious beliefs, I have my religious beliefs, and live and let live, which is what we're discussing in our current Rav Lichtenstein essay, the limits of toleration on Thursday mornings. But the issue is, what happens when the kid wants to come home and he's in the same house as his parents, who he deems as not being religious enough for him? So the question of this tshuva is, he comes home and he sees that his parents, like most households, have a television in it. And he wants to know, he asks his rabbi, is it permissible for me to sabotage the remote or destroy my parents' television so I can stop them from sinning by watching TV? That is the question of the tshuva. And I know I'm getting a number of chuckles now, and I won't lie and say that wasn't my intention, because I think, you know, just before we get into the halachos, the premise of the tshuva is amusing almost, because for us, it's like, what is that question even? Where's that coming from? So if you scroll down in the document that I gave you, let me put it back on the screen. I want to familiarize ourselves with the Haredi approach to internet. Now, I know we're all familiar that the more Haredi community, the more isolationist in philosophy, but I just want to bring the point home. So has anyone ever heard of the Asifa? Does that mean anything to anyone? The Asifa?
Mm. Yeah.
Oh, who said yeah?
Toby,
what was the Asifa?
I don't think I can describe it. I just remember hearing of it. It was some kind of a conference, I think, where they discussed like ushering TV and things like that. Something like that?
Yes, something like that. So if you look at the photo that I'm sharing on the screen now, they gathered in Citi Field and it was called the Ichud HaKehilos, and they got together for this Asifa, which literally means the gathering. And you can see on the
advertising. When was this, Rabbi?
This was in Citi Field. Was it? 2012. Yeah, right there on the ad. You can see it. Chaf Ches Iyar Tavshin Ayin Beis. You got the Hebrew date as well. So if you look closely over here, so it says we're all coming together to face the generations challenge. Kishechad Belevechad. So now, what's the challenge that of the generation that we're coming to address? It's basically television and unfiltered internet access. The concern, really, which is a legitimate concern, is that people use the internet for pornography. They use it for watching things that are illicit on there. Now, I think most people who are on with us right now realize that the internet can be used for Zoom as well. Hence, we wouldn't be able to learn Torah if we prohibited using the internet. And the Haredi community, I think this is now 9 years, basically 9 years later, they're becoming more open to having internet. My school that I grew up in, Yeshiva Darche Torah in Far Rockaway, they used to not have a website until like 2 years ago. Now they have a website. So eventually you need to move forward, but how do you do it carefully? But when you look at the advertising over here, it says the internet demands a huge solution. And my favorite part is it says we're all coming together. So they're trying to go for diversity. So you have this all male group over here, and you have people with like hats, different kinds of hats, ties. Yeah. And then like you have this one guy who's not wearing a suit jacket. So that's like the diverse caucus that's coming together. But I mean, the point being is that it's treated as a very serious issue. When I was in school, there was something called the shtar, which means the document that people would basically sign. They would for 30 days, they wouldn't watch any movies. They wouldn't go on the internet. And then if you kept to it, you got free Chinese at the end of the day. So I was making the cheshbon for myself. I said, not watching movies for a month or getting one free meal of Chinese. The calculus didn't really work for me. It didn't seem like a worthwhile cost benefit analysis. But I know I can't adequately convey it without someone actually living in the culture. But television and internet, suffice to say, is not looked upon in a positive light. I remember when I grew up, so we had a television in my home. But I remember as a kid, I went to school. And the one of my rebbeim, he said, how can you have a toilet bowl in your living room? I said, toilet bowl in my living room, it's in the bathroom. He said, if you have a television in your living room, that's a toilet bowl in there.
Disgusting. And
so I remember I felt guilty almost because I was thinking to myself, wait, I'm being told that television is bad and that it's for people who are not religious. But then why do I have one in my home? I know that my family is observant and is keeping halacha properly. So I remember I was like trying to like make sense of what seemed like a contradiction to me. So anyway, that's the basic background. And hopefully with that in mind, we can understand. What, Susan?
I went to school with a girl whose family did not have a television, had nothing to do with religion.
Right. It could be education as well. There's other reasons. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Oh, you're saying many years back. That went over my head. That was good. All right. But yes, I'm definitely speaking more, I guess, my experience. That is true. Okay. So now that we understand the background about how serious this Rav Shermach's community takes television, one could begin to understand the question of, well, if I come home and I see that my parents are doing something that I think is absolutely abhorrent and immoral, is it my obligation to stop them from doing that, even at the cost of causing them some form of minor monetary damage? So that is the question of this tshuva. But perhaps we could think about examples in our own lives where maybe television isn't the thing that we consider to be immoral, but maybe there are certain things that we consider to be sinful, problematic, or not healthy for our loved ones and friends, and to what extent are we obligated to go to make sure that they don't do something that we think is harmful for themselves?
Rabbi?
And again, one moment. And again, I think this, for those who are with us on a Thursday morning, the question of tolerance and pluralism really fits into this question. Phyllis?
Does that fit into the Hocheach Tocheach category?
Absolutely. Yes. So Phyllis
talking about parents, though, You have Kibbutz Abed.
Yeah, Kibbutz
Abed. Ah, very good.
So where does that stand, the two of them?
Very good. So you're right. So Hochiyah Tochiyah Chesamisechem, which is the obligation for one Jew to rebuke another Jew. In other words, if Reuven sees Shimon's is eating pork. Reuven has an obligation to tell Shimon, why are you eating pork? There's 613 in Avratna. Go eat some kosher food. We have good options. So that's the obligation to Torah. Now this becomes more complicated, Phyllis and Dean are saying, because, well, rebuking is not something that one is supposed to do to their parents, because there's Kaveh Sevicha Vesimecha. There's the imperative to give honor, to respect one's parents. So, of course, the answer will need to be that it has to be done in a tactful way, not in a condescending manner, because that definitely would step over certain boundaries. But we're not going to go into it now, but we right now are looking at Siman Shin Samech Ches, 368. But if somehow anyone else has the full book with them at home, in Tshuva Siman Shinun Aleph, which is 351, a little bit earlier, he has a tshuva about how is Baal Tshuva supposed to relate to his parents. And he actually says in that tshuva there, I'll read you just a short excerpt. He says that it's a good thing for a Baal Tshuva. So again, a Baal Tshuva, let me just define the term for not familiar. Someone who does tshuva, someone who repents, someone who wasn't observant, now chooses to live an observant lifestyle. So he should spend time with his parents. However, he says, now this is a very difficult reality that happens to some families. Let's say this Baal Tshuva, he now has children and he wants to go visit the grandparents. But in the grandparents' home, there's pritzus. What's a good translation for pritzus? Basically, there's television over there, and there's pictures of people who are not dressed appropriately on it, or they speak nivel peh, they speak inappropriately. Then he can't, and then it's actually problematic for him to bring his children there. And Rav Moshe Sharma says about tshuva, until he could get the grandparents to agree to cover up the television when the grandkids come over, he shouldn't visit the grandparents. He shouldn't visit his parents, which is funny because I remember as a kid, not the grandparents that are here with us this evening, but from my father's side, when we go visit my father's parents, the big thing was always watching cable television as a kid because we didn't buy cable. So we just had the VCR, but we go to the grandparents to watch cable. So that's really the situation here. So it happens sometimes in the Kirov industry where they successfully get someone to become observant, but then they unfortunately also give the advice that they should disassociate themselves from their parents who are not observant. And that's a very unfortunate, this is my opinion I'm giving right now, it's not Rosh Sternbach's opinion, but I think it's very unfortunate when that kind of advice is given, because if the Torah is being used to break ties between people and to destroy relationships, that's not really, I think, what the goal of the Torah is. So that's something that, I wish people who are in that industry were more careful about. But anyway, enough of my opinions. Let's get to Rav Moshe Sternbach's opinions a little more. So let's jump into the tshuva. Again, feel welcome to follow in the Hebrew. And if you want, I have a special treat for you. There's a full translation of the tshuva in the English as well, so you can follow along there. The prohibition to watch television.
I'll be out there in a few minutes. This guy's going to talk another 15 minutes.
Oh. The prohibition to watch television is extremely severe. It is close to committing sexual immorality. Because by watching what is on the television there, it causes someone to be drawn towards promiscuity. Therefore, one should not watch television. This comes up in the laws of Shabbos. A psik resha means if I drag a chair through the dirt on Shabbos and I know it's going to make a hole, my intention is not to make a hole, but it's going to make a hole in the ground, which you're not allowed to dig on Shabbos. Now, I'm not allowed to drag that chair through the dirt because it's a psik resha, 100% chance it's going to create a violation on Shabbos. So he's saying it's a psik resha. If one has a television in their home, they are guaranteed at some point to violate the prohibition of watching inappropriate material. Shall a gore in televisia bebais zemitameis amistaklin bo rechmano litzlan? Because if someone lives in a house with a television, they are going to violate that prohibition. It's almost like those who are with us on our Sunday morning Chumash class, where we talked about the prohibition to have false measures and weights. One's not even allowed to keep it in their home. So he's saying, if you keep this television in your home, you're going to come to violate the prohibition at some point. And it's an interesting conversation I was having today with two other rabbis. One rabbi asked the other, are you going to be, oh, so have you watched the most recent Wonder Woman movie? And he said, I'm not. The other rabbi responded, I'm not watching that movie because it features a scantily clad woman as the main character. So why would I watch a whole movie about that? So it's interesting because for some people, they don't even, you know, wouldn't even occur to them that that's something problematic. Whereas for others, especially Ramosha Sternbach, that is what he's referring to. He's not afraid that people are going to watch pornographic material on TV, but it's that he considers a lot of material that some people, that some of us might not even think about, he considers that just as bad as pornographic, because those are the standards that he's accustomed to. And those are not the standard, and he doesn't have the standards of what the general public has. There's a whole side discussion about how TV material has become more sexualized over time, where every movie, you'll forgive me, but every movie requires a sex scene now. My understanding was, for some of us, some of those who are logged on tonight, when you were growing up, that was not the case. In fact, in some old TV shows, they wouldn't even show a man and woman who were married in the same bed together just in the morning. So definitely television has gone down a certain path, which anyone with religious sensibilities would probably notice is very uncomfortable. So that's what Ramosha Sternbach is talking about. So what's interesting about this tshuva is he doesn't even get into maybe it's mutter to watch a rated G movie, but not a PG-13. He doesn't get into any of that. He just says unequivocally, having a television in your house automatically leads to sin. No conversation, no discussion. And that is the premise that this tshuva is predicated on. That is the premise. We're not even asking that question whether TV is mutter or not. It's usser. And now that we know that it's prohibited to have a television in one's house, is this Baal tshuva allowed to destroy this object which is causing his family to sin? So here we go. The great leaders of halacha when it comes to monetary matters, like Tzosa Choshen and Sivos HaMishpat. So the question is, Imadin Kfiya L'Kaim HaMitzos Moser L'Beistin Dafka Olucho Echa Ve'Echad. So there is a rule that based in that the Jewish court system, if they see that somebody is not fulfilling a mitzvah, that somebody is committing a sin, based in the Jewish court system has a right to step in and to prevent that person from committing sinful actions. So the question is, when we say Beis Din is required, do we mean literally a Beis Din, a court? Or does it mean general Jewish society that we have a responsibility to stop someone, to coerce, rather not to stop, to coerce someone not to commit a sin?
Rabbi, I have a question.
Yes, Susan.
The question is, if someone's in the privacy of their own home, and so in a way it doesn't affect the general community, I mean, is that a different issue than if, let's say, they were watching an outdoor movie and other people could see you watching it and so forth, and that would be handled differently?
So your intuition is correct, Susan. There would be a distinction because if someone, again, we're working with Ramosha Sternbach's premise that television is problematic inherently. So if one is has a public movie presentation that has inappropriate material, there'd be an additional prohibition of lifnei iver lo sigtein michshol, that they are placing a stumbling block in front of a blind person, that they are enabling others to commit a sin as well. But if someone is doing it in the privacy of their own home, this is the beginning of the beginning of Orach Chaim, the beginning of the Shulchan Aruch, the Jewish code of law. It says, don't think just because you're in your own house, it doesn't mean that God isn't with you as well. So I think you are correct. It would be less urgent to address if someone is committing a sin privately, but it would be a sin nonetheless on the books. So, okay. So there's a machlokis, a dispute between a Ksos HaChoshen and a Sivos HaMishpat. The Ksos HaChoshen says only a Beis Din is allowed to get involved in coercing people and making sure that they adhere to the mitzvah of the Torah. It's not your neighbor's business, like I think what Susan's getting to. It's not your neighbor's business to start monitoring what you're doing in the privacy of your own home. It's not your neighbor's business to start getting involved in, you know, forcing you to do things in your life that you're not necessarily doing. So lefi zeh gam benido nidan l'nafmi ashari lelifo lefi kocho avalksos achos lesivus hamishpat ashari lelifo lefi kocho avalksos achos shdeshayach lebeisd in davka azai elos chus lahazik shachiv al beisd in davka lochiv al lahazik mamam. So it would seem one might be tempted to say that the question of whether this bal tshuva is allowed to destroy his parents' television set. Or, you know, not destroy a television per se, but sabotage the remote, that it won't be able to turn on the TV in a very subtle way. That's really the question here. So it might be toloi, it might be contingent on this dispute in Jewish monetary law. Does a person who's not a member of the Beis Din have a right to step in and ensure that the other person, that his friend or his family member, is not committing a sin? One might be tempted to say that. However, he says, even according to the opinion that of the Nesivos HaMishpat, which would seem to enable, which would seem to give license to this Baal Tshuva to destroy his parents' remote, it still might not be the case that we could permit that here. Why? Next paragraph. You know, it's a good policy to let Beis Din make that decision, to let the Jewish court, to let the Rabbanim make that decision. Why? And chay mashvi be yireim shedin kfiya ashet tetsi nafsho who begeter dina knosos to buy mumchin ber tzrol dafka. Ba'av imi ikir hadin mutal kol echvecha. Even if we were to say in theory that each and every individual, in principle, halacha requires them to coerce their fellow Jew to make sure that they are keeping in line with halacha. Mir she'ein lahafkir mamon yisrael bechinam. We can't just be mafkir. We can't just declare that everyone's property is up for being destroyed. We can't just throw out everyone's ownership of their property. Rather, one should consult a Beis Din, should consult a third party. Because why? What's this Baal Tshuva trying to do? He's trying to help his family. Well, you know what he's going to do by destroying the remote to their TV? He's going to create
the family.
He's going to destroy the family, God forbid. He's going to create further separation between him and his parents, right? If the kid comes back and he's flipped out from yeshiva and the parents are already like, oh my gosh, why do we spend all this tuition money to send him to yeshiva? What are they teaching him over there? They're indoctrinating him. And then their suspicions come to fruition and they are proven correct when he destroys the remote. It's going to be terrible for the family. The ankle because you know what's going to happen? People are going to say, I'm working l'shem shemayim. I'm doing this for the sake of heaven. My intentions are pure. I just want to help you by destroying your television set. You know, the issue is most people, I like to think that when I do things, I do them for the right reason. The issue is that if I'm always convinced I'm doing things for the right reason, I might rationalize destroying your property because it's for your benefit. The consequences are disastrous because then I could find any reason to destroy your property. If I don't like somebody, I could say, I'm just doing them a favor by denting their car, by keying their car. They needed that because they were too vain. You know, it could go anywhere. Zadie, were you going to say something?
It's a futile act to destroy the remote. They'll just buy a new remote.
Right. So I think part of the issue, well, there's really two issues here. One is from a strictly legal standpoint, am I allowed to destroy someone's property to stop them from sinning? And then the second factor that we are considering here is not just from a strictly legal perspective, but is there a net gain to me doing this? So what Ramos Sharma's saying right now is maybe from a technical legal standpoint, he actually would be licensed to destroy that remote, but it's not advisable from a pastoral standpoint, which is a very good distinction over here. There's the legal advice, but then there's the pastoral advice that he's giving as well. So that's an important category. Ubeikar hadin, ulei rak b'mitzvah shikaro mamon kofen oso motalikach mamono. Maybe this is a bit of a parenthetical, but he says maybe when it comes only to mitzvos which require money, are we allowed? Does the beis din force someone to do it? Alakanshe ikar achiv hu limnoa meiser lo shayach liyachel likach mamono midin kfiya. The whole, this is a technical point. If we get it, good. If not, it's fine. But it's possible that the whole legal mechanism of kefiah, that's the Hebrew word for it, of coercion, it's only when it comes to monetary matters. So if someone refuses to buy a lulav and esrog for sukkahs, the Beis Din will say, okay, we're going to have to take money from your account in order to purchase a lulav and esrog for you. Right? Imagine we did that at the shul. Oh, you know, we see on the membership over here, you weren't signed up for lulav and esrog. Or, you know, I think you can really go for the mahadran set, not for the basic set. We'll charge you a few more bucks for that. Trust me, I know this year everything was just run by Rabbi Cohen, myself, and a few volunteers, but we didn't do that to anyone. You got what you ordered, hopefully. But that's basically where kfiya would come in. But it might not apply over here. Now, here is I'm trying to think of the right adjective for this, but it's an interesting Gemara that we're going to look at in the next paragraph for those who are following in the Hebrew. It starts with the word ubebrachos. So the Talmud in Brachos tells us, I know this is definitely not going to agree with modern sensitivities or standards, but Torah is Torah. This is what it says. The chasidei kadmoi kishalosha isha begadim adumim shein pritzus. So the early righteous men, that when there was a woman who would be dressing in red clothing, so in rabbinic literature, and I think today also possibly as well, depending how it's done, a woman wearing red clothing is seen as promiscuous. So if they see a woman walking around in this red promiscuous clothing, karuha begadim, they are allowed to confiscate the, I guess once she's already in a different outfit, they confiscate that set of clothing. Even if it cost 400 zuz, just to give you an idea of how much 400 zuz is, you pay 200 zuz in a ksuba document. That's the severance payment that a husband gives to his wife in the event that he has to divorce her or he dies first. This is double the amount, so that's a lot of money. They can tear up her property. She owns that dress. It's her dress. She owns it. She bought it legally, but because she is committing a sinful action with it, they are permitted to tear it up. Now, if it would cause a chil Hashem, that you'll see an article in the Forward the next day saying rabbis tear up women's clothing. You know, that's like the front page of the Jewish Telegraphic Agency or something like that. So then they should compensate her for it. But the kol shekein, and now here's the analogy. If they could do that for clothing, which is promiscuous and causes others to sin, then certainly for the modern day incarnation of it, televizia, shemitame od yoser, television, which is able to cause even more spiritual harm. And what's the precedent for this? In Sefer Bereishis, if you're not looking inside, here's the riddle. Where in the book of Genesis, in the stories of Genesis and Sefer Bereishis, do we see that somebody destroys or steals someone's property in order to stop them from sinning? It's more than one place, actually. I'm thinking of one, but what can we think of?
When Reuven moves his father's bed.
So what's the sin there?
Well, wasn't he later punished for having done that?
Oh, okay. So he committed a sin
of property because he wanted to prevent what he considered was a relationship that shouldn't happen.
Okay. So he thought that Yaakov might have been doing something that was not up to his ethical standards. Mm-hmm. But I'm that's not exactly what I'm thinking of, because
what's the question again?
Yaakov was committing a sin per se. Phyllis,
what's
the
question again?
Where in the stories and the narratives in the book of Genesis Can we think of an instance where someone destroyed another person's property to prevent them from sinning?
Yeah, Abraham and the idols. But that's
I knew someone was going to say that. Very good, Phyllis. So,
And there's also Rachel and the Tefillah.
Ah, good. That's the example where Moshe Sternbach is. So if we remember, if we could rewind back to Sefer Bereishis, the story of Rachel, Rachel steals Lavan's truffim. I never, you know, truffim are basically just translated as idols. I always just thought of it as chocolate truffles. That's what I think of every time I read it, and it makes me hungry. But Rachel stole the Avodah Zarah. She stole the idols from her father, Lavan. Why? What was the goal? To save her father from committing more sins of idolatry. Now, it happens to be she dies, but she doesn't die necessarily because she stole the idols. There is debate about that. But you'll see over here in this next paragraph, where Moshe Sternbach says, let's read it. In general, one needs to ask their local Orthodox rabbi. Usually I say local mono-Orthodox rabbi, but that's not what he has in mind, trust me. The Gamrav Arabar Hava Amar Masun Masun, that one has to be deliberate, one has to be measured when they make decisions. Ba'afilu Rachel Imenu Shiganva Hatrafa Me'avila Frisha Me'avodazara. When Rachel stole the idols from her father to help him, but she hid the fact that she stole them from her husband Yaakov, from Jacob. Yaakov said, "Whoever your gods will be found with, whoever the idols will be found with, they shall not live." And therefore, Rachel died prematurely on the way because Yaakov cursed whoever would be found with the truffin. Unbeknownst to him, unfortunately, that was his beloved wife, Rachel. Rachel died because of this imprecation that Yaakov made on whoever stole the truffin, the Avodah Zarah. And it was this anger that Lavan had that nearly caused Lavan to want to destroy the Jewish people. Had God not come to Lavan, Lavan would have attacked Yaakov and could have killed him. Therefore, she was punished for it. Akash Baruch Hu, Daktik im Hatzakonis Rachel imenu kechud hasayar, because God, in our Shula Shara Gmul class, for those who were there on Thursday mornings, we talked about how God judges the righteous, kechud hasayra, up until a hair's breadth. God scrutinizes them. So Rachel is that first example. Arguably, if you look at the Medrash, like Phyllis said, Avram is the first example. But Rachel, really, in the text, is the first example of a Baas Tshuva who steals or destroys her parents' item that they are using to commit a sin. So this question that Moshe Sternbach is getting in the 20th – I think this is 20th century because this is the first volume in modern day. Rachel Imenu is really the source for this. And now one could read the story either way. One could say, well, Rachel did the wrong thing by stealing her father's idols, even though he was committing a sin with them. So maybe this is a case in point that the Baal Tshuva should not be sabotaging his parents' remote. On the other hand – maybe the only reason Rachel died was she did the right thing, but because Yaakov cursed whoever stole the truffim, she didn't die because she committed a sin, but she died because of that curse. She died prematurely. One could read the narrative either way.
I heard a different explanation.
Oh, you have a third explanation.
The explanation that I heard was that the prohibition against marrying sisters, and once they crossed into Eretz Yisrael, Yaakov was in violation of that prohibition. And although I haven't heard an explanation why she rather than Leah died, right, she was the second one that he married. And so perhaps that's why. But the curse was whoever is found with the idols. Mm. Was she found with them?
So that's a good point. Sadie, thank you for bringing in that other explanation for why she had to die along the way, because Otherwise, Yaakov would have remained married to two women. And once he entered the land of Israel, he had to adhere to the laws of the Torah of not marrying two sisters.
Right.
So the I don't think it means literally someone had to find her with it, but it's more in like the passive sense. Whoever it is found with currently, meaning whoever possesses them as of the moment. That's what Yaakov meant. Not whoever I discover later on. That's my understanding of it, at least.
Being a lawyer, I'm looking at the actual language of the curse.
Ah, okay. You know, we need Ruckel's lawyers to come and defend her from that.
Look, she should have had you. Over the theft of his idols. And so the curse is that whoever is caught, you say somebody in my family stole it, whoever is caught with it, they will die. Nobody's caught with it.
Okay. So you know what? If Ruckel had you on her legal team back then, maybe things would have turned out differently. But I guess that's the case here.
You'd have to pay my fee.
Okay, but let's wrap up the tshuva. Ulepamim lo igia dinas man lafrishu mitelevizia. You know, it's possible. Moshe Shurma is very understanding. He has very radical and resolute positions on issues. He says television is absolutely prohibited, but he's very understanding that someone can't just become observant overnight. That if I wasn't keeping kashrus, Shabbos, family purity, and other important areas of halacha, I can't just wake up one day and say, I'm going to keep all the laws of Shabbos, I'm going to keep all the laws of kashrus. That's just not realistic, and it's not within human nature to do that. People change in gradations. People change slowly. They have to make reasonable changes to their lifestyle over time. So he says it's possible, he's advising this Baal Tshuva, it's possible your parents just aren't ready to give it up. And to just all of a sudden try destroying their TV out of nowhere is not going to be helpful. Maybe, you know, if you try suggesting to them, don't watch, rated R films with nudity in it, maybe that's a way forward. And slowly but surely you could make sure they're only, well, in his case, not watching anything at all, or I guess if I were to modify it, watching appropriate material. But he understands that can't just happen overnight. Upula shlo bizmana alul lepam lekalkel. And if you do something not in the right time, it caused greater destruction than had you not done it at all. L'chol eis l'chol zman, and he quotes Ecclesiastes, for everything there is a proper time. Ube atzas chacham yishkon orv ein lozos midivrim. So you should consult the rabbis, consult a mentor, consult a rabbinic mentor to find out what they advise you for your particular situation. Because each and every person, we love to label and categorize people and classify them in the same categories, but each and every person with their own family has their own idiosyncrasies and unique elements that it takes someone who actually knows the person, the Baal Tshuva, the family, to give any reasonable advice. But he says to the Baal Tshuva, try to advise your family why, explain to them why it's problematic. Don't just come in there one day, make a clap out of you and say, Rabbi Sai, I just learned that television is usur, it's prohibited, I'm not allowed to have it. Like, try to have a conversation with your parents. Just explain to them where you're coming from. Don't just say, my rabbi in Israel told me this. You know, just have a normal conversation with your parents. Well, here's the thing, though. Like, you know, what's his advice? What should he be telling his parents? So I just interpret it in a way that I would advise someone, but here's what he says. So I'm not imposing my own read of the text. You should say to them, if you enjoy your little bit of time watching these hevel, these empty shows, eventually the entire family will be drawn down into the depths of the abyss. There is nothing as terrible as this that could destroy one's spirituality. Now, just what's the answer? Is he allowed to destroy the remote? He's allowed to destroy the TV when it comes to destroying it. And if he would have to pay for it also, the question is, would he then have to pay back as well if he wasn't allowed to destroy it? One should ask their local Orthodox rabbi, he says. But one who has faith in the rabbis, this is a very important idea in the Haredi world, Das Torah, one who has faith in their posek, in their rabbi to guide them in these matters, he will only find blessing in the results. Arkan, that is the end of the Teshuva, which I now submit to the jury in front of me. And I want to ask you for your opinions on this, if we have any thoughts.
Rabbi.
Lloyd, please. Oh, you just muted yourself. Lloyd, you need to unmute.
Okay.
Oh, no, no, no longer the echo or the reverberating voice in heaven. No bascule.
Well, Rabbi, if you were banned and say it's prohibited to have a TV set, and yet we're having a Zoom conference on a TV set.
So I want to clarify. Ramosha Sherma's position is not my position. I'm just presenting Ramosha Sherma's position. If you want to know, Marissa and I actually we bought a TV after we moved here into Stamford, and we had this crazy experience where we went to, I think, Westchester area to get it, but it was so big we only had a sedan at the time, a Honda Civic. And me and this guy are sitting, like, we're standing outside the store trying to fit it into our sedan. We had to break the foam off the protective layer to fit in the back of our car because our trunk wasn't big enough. So it was a traumatic day for all of us.
You bought a big TV.
We had to push the chairs in the front all the way up, and I was like driving like this all the way back. It wasn't the safest thing. But the point being is, and I think this is the difference. This really highlights interesting the more modern Orthodox versus Haredi philosophy of life. In the Haredi philosophy of life, it's more important to protect yourself from something which could potentially give harm rather than take the risk of having the benefits. The modern Orthodox approach, which I strongly identify, is that there is a lot in the world that God gives us to interact with. There's a lot that science and culture have to offer us. And I think our goal really is to try to discern that which is beneficial to our wholesome religious lives in serving God, and that which, unfortunately, is counterproductive to that. So, if, you know, a television is really just a flashpoint for where this disagreement comes to a head. But there's really a more fundamental philosophical disagreement here, which is, do I take the risk of benefiting, but at the risk of compromising my spiritual integrity? Or do I just say, look, I don't need a television in my house. I can just read an art scroll novel instead, and suffice with that for entertainment, which, whatever, that's another discussion. That's really what it comes down to. Okay.
Bravo. Well, these days, TVs are sort of getting passe.
What?
Exactly, when, right. So that's why it's a confusing premise for us.
When was this?
Rabbi, you have to find a rabbi that'll give you the answer you want to hear.
Actually, Audrey, the funny thing is that I don't know if you were here for it, but on my interview, that was the shear I gave, which is if you're allowed to go rabbi shopping.
Well,
I don't know who was there for, but maybe I'll.
I just remember the green screen.
What year was this tshuva written?
So I don't have the precise year, but to give you an idea, he has 7 volumes of responsa that are printed right now. This is volume number 1. So whenever was the earliest date that he started writing Shuvos? This is what he wrote. So the reason it doesn't say anything about internet in here is because this Shuva was written before the internet.
He doesn't know about internet, and he didn't know also that there are parental controls. And all
so
kinds
this,
of ways
predated
that you could be,
all exactly.
Well, he would still consider it a very an outer worldly temptation.
Yeah, but you can now control it more. You can. There are things on TV that you can watch that are perfectly fine to watch.
Of course, there are.
You might even get smarter from it.
Exactly.
And
that was on years ago.
And now we have computers. He would have said that computers should not ever.
They don't use them in the Haredi. They sometimes use them for work, but they don't have them in their homes, a lot of them.
Toby?
I was going to say, over the last few months, there has been a slew of very, very right-wing yeshivas, some of them from your neck of the woods, who've been making use of Zoom for their fundraisers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeshiva Katan of Long Island just had a whole thing with, you know, the Bayam giving
welcome to the modern world.
Ashanda.
And everything. And you should see what those are, you know, you were talking about Shtarka Rebbeim. But when there's, you know, They found their way around it.
What a Shanda. Oh, my God. Bushan Kherpa.
My cousin's a Dayan in Israel, and I don't think they used computers at their yeshiva for a long time, but eventually they did. They still don't use them in the house.
Which one are you talking about, Susan?
I have a cousin who's a Dayan in Israel.
Oh.
But his daughter, I guess, is stepped down a little bit, so she uses the internet now.
Well, actually, so that's the thing, though, because the main concern for internet is viewing sexual pornographic material. So many people in the more right-wing world, they're more okay with women going on the internet than they are with men going on the internet. Mm-hmm. So I remember my Rebbe in ninth grade, he actually, when he needed, let's say, to order clothing or something, so mm-hmm. he would instruct his wife to go on the internet for him to
that's
order
interesting.
Things. So, I mean, it's a general thing. It's a general thing.
Especially now in the pandemic. I mean, you know, when people are shopping on the internet for necessities.
So I think that it's the trend. And going back to that picture that I showed us before about the Asifa didn't say, and I think Susan, you may have pointed this out before, they weren't arguing that no one should ever go on the internet at all because people might need it for business. What they're saying is if you don't need to, it's for strictly for recreation, then cut your losses, find other means of recreation. So that's the point that they're making. But I think as time goes on, and like Toby pointed out, we just need to use it for Zoom nowadays. I think it's becoming more acceptable to have it in the communities, and people install filters on their computer to prevent, you know, like, or parental, child protection, parental features on there. So that's something that's being done. And honestly, like a filter for a child shouldn't only be something that would be considered in the Haredi world. I would think responsible parenting in general, one might want to consider the possibility of just filtering and giving a, you know, keeping their kid away from those kind of things. I'm not saying you should. I'm saying it's a consideration.
Does he include Dungeons and Dragons in that?
So there, he doesn't have that, but there is a chew-up from Rav Nachum Rabinovich, which I hope to do, about whether it's mutter to do magic and trick people into magic and that kind of stuff.
You know, the funny thing is now you actually have almost the opposite. What happens if in a time of pandemic like now, and the government is requiring that the children have access to computer devices mm-hmm. to be able to do remote learning? Are you allowed to say, I'm not going to follow the government law?
Because I'm off to Dina.
Yeah.
So you might, perhaps, though, just not from a halakhic standpoint, from a sociological standpoint, that wouldn't stop the community from not listening to the government, because as some of us might be aware, there's already a huge fight between some of the haters in Brooklyn and the city of New York about whether they have to conform to the hours required for secular education. So there's clearly already a lot of there's a lot of disapproval on their part. There's a lot of instances where they are not following the rules. So sociologically, I don't think they would listen if they were required.
Most yeshiva are open now.
Concerned that the Supreme Court has already slapped down New York's governor because he prohibited houses of worship from having more than a minuscule number of people, max of 25 people. You might have a shul that holds 4,000, or there's a Catholic church that holds 10,000, right. And he's limiting it to 25, and the Supreme Court said he was violating the Constitution. The question of whether government authorities have the legal authority to issue the orders that they're issuing, and as an attorney, what I see in New York, he's completely beyond his authority.
Right, so that's definitely a topic unto itself, and I think a few months ago we had... what was his name from, we had a lawyer actually speak to us who specialized, what was his name?
Yeah, he was a constitutional law expert. By,
yeah, I can't remember his name.
I'm blanking out, but he had this whole presentation.
California.
On discrimination. He specializes in religious discrimination law. So he gave a whole presentation on whether it was religious discrimination, what Cuomo was doing. So it's very fascinating. I'll try to find the recording. It might interest you. But anyway, we're at 9:00, so it's been an hour. Yasher Koach, everyone. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to learning again next week.
Very nice. Thank you.